Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the irony that not just one president, Richard Nixon, was brought down by secret tape recordings, but that another, Donald Trump, could also be vulnerable to the many recordings his former fixer, Michael Cohen, has of conversations between them. The first of which has been made public involving a discussion over the payment of hush money just before the 2016 election to a playmate with whom Trump is alleged to have had a year-long extramarital affair. The person who revealed the existence of the secret White House recording system that finally provided the evidence during the Watergate hearing to back up the word of John Dean against all the president's men, Alexander Butterfield, joins us. He served as deputy assistant to President Richard Nixon from 1969 to 1973 and later served as administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration and is the subject of the latest book by Bob Woodward, The Last of the President's Men. We will discuss the stark difference between two flawed presidents, one Nixon, who was unusually prepared for the office and was exceedingly competent, while the other in office now, Donald Trump, was totally unprepared and is dangerously incompetent. Then we'll examine the challenges facing the Democrats as we head into the midterm elections 100 days away and speak with Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly, who was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Clinton, about his article in the Washington Monthly, Winning is Not Enough. We'll discuss the alarming statistic that only one-third of Democrats voted in the last midterm election, prompting President Obama to remark that Democrats have an almost genetic problem of not voting in midterms, which calls into question whether the so-called blue wave will sweep them into control of the House and Senate in November. Paul Glastras argues that merely winning is not enough. To save our democracy, Democrats need to win big. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the wildfires raging across California and as far away as Greece and Sweden from an expert on the history, ecology, and management of fires, Stephen Pine, the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and author of Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. He joins us to discuss the difference between good and bad forest fires and what can be done to prevent devastating urban fires such as what just happened in Redding, California, and recently in Santa Rosa, California, and Gatlinburg, Tennessee. And joining us now is Alexander Butterfield, a retired U.S. military officer, public servant, and businessman. He served as deputy assistant to President Richard Nixon from 1969 to 1973. He revealed the existence of the White House taping system on July 13, 1973, during the Watergate scandal investigation. And from 1973 to 1975, he served as administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. He is the subject of Bob Woodward's latest book, The Last of the President's Men. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Butterfield. Are you there, Alex?
Yes, I'm here, Ian, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks, Alex. And my less than fair and balanced opening, I mentioned the difference between Richard Nixon being unusually prepared for the office and exceedingly competent, while the other in office now, Donald Trump, was totally unprepared and is dangerously incompetent. What is your opinion of the difference between the two presidents?
Well, yes, you're essentially right on target. Nixon had been in government most of his adult life. He understood that word, that important word, governance. He understood governance. He also understood the importance of diplomacy and sort of as a hobby. He was very well versed in international affairs. He liked international affairs. He liked dealing with other countries, and I think he felt he was pretty good at it. But he had his flaws, as we all know. He had a lot of complexes, and we could get into that, but his complexes hurt him quite a bit, I think, and were also responsible for some of his misjudgments. But Trump, I wouldn't say that Trump is stupid. I imagine he's fairly smart in certain areas, and even wily. I think he's probably a wily SOB, but he's appallingly ignorant. And his fans don't seem to understand that. Ignorant of the important things, American history, governance, that word governance again. And I think in many ways, both of these guys are their own worst enemies in some way.
Well, I think Nixon had some character flaws, unquestionably, and perhaps some psychological flaws towards the end. But it seems that Donald Trump has fairly deep and evident psychological flaws.
Oh, yeah, I sure think so. When that book came out a while back, I wish I could think of the name of it, in which 27 psychiatrists and clinical psychologists and people who worked with people therapeutically, 27 of them, all of them were in agreement that that Trump is, people before I ever Trump came to the fore as he in politics, he was known as a pathological liar and a pathological narcissist. And people just seem to forget that word pathological. But if that's true, and I can't say that it's true, but these psychiatrists and psychologists in this book that came out a while back, but the damn book just came and went. It didn't make the splash I hoped it would. They all agreed that he doesn't see reality as we do. He does have a problem. And if it is pathological, then it's disease-oriented. That's what pathological means. And so you could say, it sounds to say it, but the president of the United States is not mentally capable of holding this office. He does have a brain disease. He's not an axe murderer, but he's a guy without conscience. He's like a sociopath. Sociopaths can be pretty evil and do a lot of harm, and they're in our midst all over the place. But we don't you agree with that?
Well, yeah, we don't normally have them in the Oval Office, and I think the book you're referring to is The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, edited by a psychiatrist at Yale, Dr. Bandy Lee. And I've spoken to some
Bandy
of the
Lee,
I've spoken to some of the contributors recently, Lance Dodis. Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Butterfield, a retired U.S. military officer, public servant, and businessman. He served as the deputy assistant to President Richard Nixon from 1969 to 1973, and revealed the existence of the White House taping system on July the 13th of 1973 during the Watergate scandal investigation. And from 1973 to 1975, he served as administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. And he's the subject of Bob Woodward's latest book, The Last of the President's Men. So turning to the comparisons, I guess you probably never ever thought that there'd be another White House tape scandal after what you went through, because you clearly were there at the Watergate hearings. And I understand you were, I think you were on your way to Russia, weren't you, when you're in the barbershop one of the hotels there in Washington, and you're looking at the White House.
The White House barber worked at the White House quite a few days of the week, but he also had a shop at the Carlton. I guess it was the Carlton Hotel, right there near 16th and I don't know what in Washington. And, I was in there getting a haircut on the morning of the 16th. You mentioned that I revealed the existence of the tapes on Friday, the 13th of July of 73, which is correct. A lot of people don't know that, but that's the day that I was under questioning. I revealed the existence of the tapes. I sure as hell did not want to Woodward sort of gets the idea that I was dying to testify. I could easily have called the committee and said, look, I have some important things that you should call me. But the Washington Post published the list of all the people that were going to be interrogated the summer of 73 and the order in which they would be called. And my name was not on that long, long list of White House aides and others. And I breathed a big sigh of relief. I didn't want to testify. I mean, you could fault me for that, really. But I liked the press. I did not respect him. I learned early on that he didn't deserve anyone's respect. When I arrived at the White House, the first thing I learned in the first couple of months was that the president of the United States was busy cheating on his taxes. A lot of people didn't know that. Very few people knew it. But I was also the deputy White House chief of staff. I was Haldeman's only deputy. So everything I did was I shared with Haldeman, working exclusively with the president. So that way I learned some things that the average person on the White House staff did not know. And that hit me first of all, so I couldn't respect him, but I worked so closely with him, I got to like him. I sort of got to like him. If people like you, you like them, and he seemed to like me. It's a human nature thing. Doesn't mean I loved him, but I sure as hell didn't want to be the one to give away the information, which I ended up doing. I ended up being the fall guy only because Woodward, incidentally, is the guy that ratted on me. He's the guy that kept calling his contact over at the Watergate committee saying, you got to call this guy Butterfield. He works for Haldeman. I don't know what he does, but he works for Haldeman, so you should call him. He seemed to suspect that I knew more than I did. But anyway, that's the way that the revelation of the tapes came about.
And what do you think of speculation now amongst the talking heads on television that Donald Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen, might be the next John Dean? I don't imagine John feels good about that being compared to Michael Cohen.
Well, I could see Trump's downfall coming right from the start. In fact, I'm amazed, really, that he's lasted this long. But I think he will surely get his comeuppance, and I think his first term. That's what I believe. And I do think Michael,
Cohen. Cohen.
The attorney?
Yeah.
Yeah, Cohen. I do think Cohen will figure prominently in that, or hasten that day, because it looks like he's flipped for sure now. They've sure drawn it out quite a bit, but he's crazy if he doesn't. He's crazy if he doesn't, because Trump, with his pathological narcissism, really does not care for other people. He really does think only about how an event is going to affect him.
Well, one of the other ironies, I guess, Alex Butterfield, is that, of course, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, married to his daughter Ivanka, he is famous for being the White House advisor who advised Donald Trump to fire the head of the FBI, James Comey, because Jared Kushner argued that the Democrats would like that because they were mad at Comey for the last-minute intervention in the elections, which Hillary Clinton claims hurt.
Right, putting Hillary at a disadvantage.
Right, yeah. She says that he cost her the election. So Jared Kushner, that was the advice he gave Trump, and then Trump went ahead and fired Comey, and that, of course, led to the appointment of the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, who may well be Trump's undoing. The second example of Jared Kushner's brilliant advice is that he was the person who advised Donald Trump not to hire Michael Cohen in the White House. And they could have given Michael Cohen some sort of sinecure in the White House. He's, you know, the executive branch has got thousands of appointments. But because of Jared Kushner's advice, Trump basically cut Michael Cohen loose, and he felt very bitter about it. And look what's happened now. So that was not exactly a smart move on Jared's part.
Yeah, that's true. No. And Trump keeps talking too much. He is, as I said earlier, his own worst enemy. He is not a bright person.
Well, the other guy that talks too much is surely Rudolph Giuliani.
Oh, I know. Well, yeah, Rudy is almost a laughing stock now.
Right.
He seems to have really changed his stripes, interestingly. But anyway, people do get confused with my testimony sometimes, but that the testimony on the tapes really happened when I was before the staff. The staff members elicited that information, and it happened to be the Republican staff member, and the Republicans were in the minority at that time. So on Monday, they called me before the formal committee, the committee members themselves, and that's when that was in the biggest hearing room up there on the Hill, and boyfriends were holding their girlfriends on their shoulders, and the place was absolutely jam-packed, and nobody knew what was coming. There was the Washington Star, which was the evening paper in Washington in those days, came out with an early edition at noon calling me the mystery witness. No one knew who I was. They just said, as I say, I was not in the lineup. They had to put me in between a couple of people on the afternoon of Monday, the 16th of July. And no one knew what it was all about. So most people were very surprised when I told them that. So I knew there that what questions I would be asked, and I knew I'd only be on for about an hour. I was only on, I guess, about an hour and a half. Thompson, Fred Thompson, who was the minority counsel, he did the questioning of me rather than Sam Dash, who was the majority counsel, who questioned most of the people.
Right. So he ended up being a Republican senator from Tennessee.
That's right. And a film actor of a pretty damn good one.
Right. But just in the last couple of minutes, how do you explain the fact that in Watergate, the Republicans worked with the Democrats against a Republican president, whereas today, in spite of all the evidence of Trump's behavior and lack of competence and recklessness and the possibility that there's some peculiar hold that Vladimir Putin of Russia has over him, the Republicans are standing by him almost in lockstep. The only critics of him are Republicans who, like John McCain, who have terminal cancer or are quitting and abandoning the office.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know how to explain that. In fact, I think those guys will go down in infamy because so much of Trump's. I mean, I think most of us felt that the chips are falling exactly where we assumed they would early on. It seemed like collusion to me when I heard about that meeting they had in Trump Tower with so many Russians. I keep wanting to call them Soviets because in my day they were Soviet Union people, but I felt that was collusion. If that isn't collusion, what the hell does collusion mean?
Right.
And
of course, Michael Cohen now said that Donald Trump knew about that meeting in advance, which is something that he denied.
But you mentioned they were pretty split along party lines in the Judiciary Committee during the deliberations of Nixon's impeachment, pretty much so. And one of the first Republicans to not cave, but to see the light was Cohen, speaking of Cohen,
right.
Who was a young representative on the Republican side. He was later Secretary of Defense for Clinton. Even though Clinton was a Democrat, he was a Republican. Clinton had him go in there Secretary of Defense. I know Cohen pretty well. He's a very savvy guy, and he was one of the first and who could see clearly that Nixon was guilty. And I testified before that committee, too, in July of 74, 1 year after the revelation of the tapes. I was the first of eight witnesses to go before the Judiciary Committee, and they were lined up according to party until Cohen, and then followed by six or seven others, and I think a total of eight Republicans did vote against Nixon in the three articles of impeachment that were passed.
Well, just in closing, though, we have a situation now, Alexander Butterfield, where the Tea Party caucus, the Freedom Caucus in the House, are trying to impeach Rod Rosenstein, which is clearly something they're doing in collusion with the White House to shut down the Mueller inquiry. And then you've got the new nominee for the Supreme Court. He apparently was against the White House turning over the tapes that you revealed. So do you think it's possible that Trump could stop this inquiry and that we won't have the equivalent of Watergate with this administration?
I think I think when it's clear to him that he's cornered, I wouldn't be surprised. He might well do that. He might well do that. I can't believe he did what he did, fire the director of the FBI, but I wouldn't put anything past him.
Well, Alexander Butterfield, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay. Well, I enjoyed it, Ian, and thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Butterfield, who's a retired U.S. military officer, public servant, and businessman. He served as the deputy assistant to President Richard Nixon from 1969 to 1973. He revealed the existence of the White House taping system on July 13th of 1973 during the Watergate scandal investigation. And from 1973 to 1975, he served as administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration. And he was the subject of Bob Woodward's latest book, The Last of the President's Men. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining the challenges facing the Democrats as we head into the midterm elections 100 days away.
Want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. From September 1998 to January of 2001, he was special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. He wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. And before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. And his latest article at the Washington Monthly is Winning is Not Enough. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Ian, great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Paul. And one of the more alarming statistics is that in the last midterm elections, only one-third of registered Democratic voters turned out to vote. And that prompted President Obama to remark that Democrats have an almost genetic problem of not voting in the midterms. So if they don't show up in 2018 in November, then this blue wave is aspiration, not reality.
Well, that's right. And, you know, the reason Democrats don't show up in midterm elections, it's not always been the case. It is the case now because of the makeup of the Democratic electorate. 30, 40 years ago, Ian, older voters were Roosevelt voters. They were Democratic voters. Older voters traditionally vote at higher rates than young people. Today, older voters tend to be people who grew up in the Eisenhower years. They're the silent generation, and they vote Republican. So the regular, always come out to vote voters these days are Republicans for demographic reasons. Meanwhile, Democrats not only are seeing huge percentages of young people supporting them, but of course, the percentage of immigrants, Hispanics, Asians, and so forth, as well as African Americans, certainly immigrants voting Democratic has grown. But these folks, immigrants, young people, traditionally tend not to vote at very high rates. So there's a built-in disadvantage for Democrats. The question is, in this midterm, are Democrats going to overcome that? And there's a lot of indication that they will, but we're going to really not know till November.
So is there a fissure in the Democratic Party, as there was during the last presidential primaries, between the Hillary wing, for the want of a better description, and the Bernie Sanders wing? Because the last thing that you need, if you've got a problem with turnout, you've got a critical election, and you're in your article that I mentioned, Paul, you say, but merely winning isn't enough. To save our democracy, Democrats need to win big. So if they're going to win big, they got to stop fighting amongst themselves and get out and vote, don't they?
Well, I think that's right. There are certainly divisions within the Democratic Party. It has always been thus. Every party has them. And I think that the ones between Hillary people and Bernie people were pretty stark in many ways in 2016. I don't think you can make the argument that they are as important in this midterm as they perhaps were in 2016. Actually, quite the contrary. The pattern has been that in each congressional district, Democrats who are best suited for those districts are the ones that have tended to win, and there have been very few cases where in, say, moderate districts where the voters are, you know, a little bit more conservative, that left challengers have really made a big dent in the primaries. Really, you've not seen the left challenge the moderates in areas where moderates tend to do better. Where the, you know, more socialist or left-leaning candidates have succeeded are in areas that are overwhelmingly liberal. So what you're seeing is pretty liberal Congress people or challengers being beaten by even more liberal challengers in those districts. So this is really I'm sort of surprised, frankly, at the unity of the Democratic Party, given that there are some big differences on philosophy and ideology going into this midterm, and the amount of if enthusiasm for voting is a measure, Democrats have it all over Republicans going into November.
But as you write in your article at the Washington Monthly, Paul Glasras, winning is not enough. Various factions on the left have debated whether. This is since 2016. Various factions on the left have debated whether Democrats' strategy should revolve around boosting turnout among its base while drawing in more highly educated suburban white voters, or on the other hand, trying to regain the support of rural and working class whites. So why would that be mutually exclusive?
Well, that's the point, I think. You've hit it right on the head. It need not be mutually exclusive. It would be suicide if the Democrats let it become mutually exclusive. And I really don't think for most active people in the party it is mutually exclusive. It's more something that reporters talk a lot about, Democrats have to make a choice between going after white working class voters in the sort of exurbs and rural areas, or bringing out their base, or going after sort of educated, affluent suburban whites. There is a tension, and the tension is if the Democrats want to encourage their base, they would focus on things like immigration, criminal justice, rights for, transgendered folks, the kinds of things that might suppress the vote or not win votes among rural and exurban whites. So there is, it's not as if there's not a tension. But I think that what we're seeing in this race in 2016 is candidates in the rural areas who are Democrats are not running on transgender rights. They're running on other things. In some cases, quite liberal things like Medicare for All, but mostly on bread and butter issues that folks out in those districts who, you know, are open to persuasion by the Democrats or are Democrats themselves are comfortable with. And those in more liberal districts are running, you know, more culturally liberal campaigns. I think that the issue for me is what happens after 2016. My whole article is really based on the presumption, and it is only a presumption because we don't know, that the Democrats take back the House. If the Democrats take back the House, then the real work begins. And my argument is that if you look back at the last 37 years of American history, since really 1982, Democrats have controlled the Congress and the White House a grand total of 4 years, meaning only in 4 years, this would be the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, the first term of the Clinton administration, and the first 2 years of the first Obama term, only during those 4 years have the Democrats been able to really move legislation. And in each case, they moved legislation and behaved in a way that left them to lose Congress in the next midterm election. Again, for some of the reasons that we discussed earlier, but also because they were trying to jam through their favored policies rather than be careful to control their own, to maintain their own power. And my argument is that in this day and age, when you only have one political party that is a small d Democratic party, when the other party, the Republican Party, is moving closer and closer to an authoritarian or illiberal model, when you have a party that is supporting a president who is showing more than a few authoritarian tendencies, that just as a matter of democratic hygiene, of support for the democratic system of government, Democrats, as the only small D party, need to think about how to maintain their power for more than 2 years. And that requires, I think, exceptionally fresh thinking on the part of the Democrats. They need new issues, and they need to get away from their squeamishness about changing policies to rebalance the electoral system that is right now skewed in the Republicans' favor.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, given how skewed the electoral system is, and you can't discount the possibility of the Russians are already messing with the electoral system in Missouri, where Senator Claire McCaskill is vulnerable. So we don't know. And of course, by the way, the Trump administration had their first National Security Council meeting, principals meeting on the issue of Russian meddling, physically meddling in our elections, screwing up with the election system and what we're going to do to prevent it in 2018. And that meeting, guess what? It lasted a half an hour. So it was a complete joke. So I'm not unconvinced that the Republicans want the Russians to help them out, which they apparently did in 2016. But what can we do to get the millennials out, to get the Latinos out, and to get the African-Americans out in 2018? And
Well, Democrats just have to do the basic blocking and tackling that any election requires. You know, phone calls, donations, talking to your friends. You know, this is now, we're now down to, you know, it's 5 minutes to midnight. We're 100 days or less from the November elections. There's not, frankly, a whole lot beyond that that anyone can do. This, you know, other than politic, politic, politic. You know, pour energy into this thing. That is what Democrats can do. The question is, if they win at least one House in November, then what do they do? Then the potential to make real change in our policies and the politics and the electoral system, then that kicks in. But none of that is possible for the Democrats unless they win one House in of Congress in November.
Well, Paul Glasser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Glasser, who's the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. And before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News and World Report. And his latest article at The Washington Monthly is Winning is Not Enough. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with an analysis of the wildfires raging across California and as far away as Greece and Sweden from an expert on the history, ecology, and management of fires. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Pine, an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pine.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
And, Stephen, it seems that here in California we're between about 90 large fires.
Well, it's that time of year, but it does seem to be exaggerated, and it does seem to be coming early at this level of ferocity.
Well, the fire season's normally, what, in September, isn't it, and October?
No, you have a summer fire season. You have a long drought. Drought period, Mediterranean climate. No, fires come. They're usually kept better under wraps. Mm-hmm. What you have in the fall are the outbreaks of these Santa Ana, Diablo, east winds that can really drive the large fires. But that's really a major after tremor. The primary fire season comes during the summer.
So it's not just California. You've got fires in Greece. You've got fires in Sweden, got record temperatures in Japan. Japan hit 106 degrees on Monday. You've had record temperatures in Massachusetts, Maine, Wyoming, Colorado, Oregon, New Mexico, and Texas. It's hard not to come to the conclusion that something's happening with global climate.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's the case. It's across the Northern Hemisphere, and it's shifted not only climate, but the whole pattern of wetting and drying, which is really what underwrites the appearance of fire. There are major droughts now in Ireland, Britain, across Northern Europe, Germany. We haven't seen large fires there, and part of the reason is that that depends on ignitions. And the population has been relatively controlled. There have been a few outbreaks in Moors in Britain and Scotland. The Swedish one is interesting because it appears to have been, the primary cause seems to have been dry lightning storm, which is very rare in Sweden. Now, Sweden goes through large fires a couple times a century. They have bad seasons. They usually contain them pretty easily. But this was a surprise because it came outside the system. And that's what I think we really need to look at. We're seeing changes in climate aggravating normal patterns. They're becoming more intense. They're becoming earlier. They're lasting longer. But if we start seeing large fire outbreaks, say, in Germany or other places that don't really have a natural fire regime, and we start seeing dry lightning accompanying them, which doesn't happen, really, then we're looking at a major phase change, a shift not just in intensity of places that normally have it, but a changing kind.
Well, one would think, just looking at the map, that the countries with the most forests are Canada and Russia. So are they vulnerable?
Well, they certainly are, and they're doubly vulnerable. All the projections highlight them because they have so much of a continental climate. They're so far away from a coastline. I mean, most of Europe is a series of peninsulas breaking down into islands. You're really not very far from the coast, even in the interior. In central Canada, in central Eurasia, you are. So you have the pattern for natural fires, and they occur very frequently on a large scale. They always have. That's just typical of the boreal forest. But they're projected to get a lot worse. So that is sort of more of the same, worsened, whereas if we start seeing stuff in Belgium or Germany, then we're really looking at a fundamental change in the patterns that will result in more fires in places that really aren't equipped for them. And that's the other thing about this, that some of these fires, like the Greek fires, and in some ways the Sweden fires, are occurring in places that don't normally have it. They may be developed countries, but they're really not equipped to handle fire busts of this sort. Sweden was very surprised. As I say, it was a kind of an unusual ignition pattern, and one of the largest fires is occurring in an artillery range with lots of unexploded ordnance. So even what they have, they can't intervene there safely, so the fires are getting larger. It would be interesting in Sweden, too, to know what exactly is burning. How much of it is really a surface fire, but large, or how much of it is really getting into the crowns, again, changing character for what that kind of regime would normally have. And that information I don't have yet.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pine, who is an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He is the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Well, most experts are saying that the jet stream is certainly dictating this unusually hot weather in the northern hemisphere. But apparently the jet stream is stalled. Is that your understanding? And that's why we're stuck with this unrelenting heat and potential for even more fires?
Well, that's my understanding, but I'm getting it all from probably the same sources you are. And it appears to be tied to a breakdown in the Arctic weather system, which would be tied to melting of the ice, exposure of more ocean, and so forth. But that's as much as I can say.
Right, but the question would be...
The other thing I would comment, though, on some of these really large damaging fires, it certainly doesn't apply to California, but in Greece, which had a similar outbreak, much more widespread and actually more damaging in 2007, is that you have a breakdown in the social capacity to respond and the capacity to plan ahead. So Greece, apart from the economic crisis and funding issues it's had, has been changed how it organized its fire services. It took it away from its forest service, which had been tied to the countryside, and turned it over to more urban fire services. And one of the consequences has been an inability to deal with fire that is not in the urban environment. So fires are moving through through cities, as we've seen, but that is a change in how people interact with these other changes in climate through the medium of fire. So that is also part of the equation, and how we choose to live on the land, how we what kind of houses we build, how we disperse or concentrate the house, what kinds of materials we use, how we put power lines across the countryside. All of these other things are interacting. So it is not just one cause. It's, you know, fire is, people want to know what's the driver here. Fire is more of a driverless car. It's barreling down the road. It's integrating everything around it. And at one time and place, one factor looms a lot larger, but it's integrating all of them. So it's not just one thing. It's one thing acting on a lot of others, integrating it in a particular way. And in some ways, that's an encouraging observation, because it suggests there are lots of points of intervention possible as well. What doesn't work is to simply try to fight them once they break out. We've tried that and tried that, and if there is any kind of natural proclivity towards fire in the landscape, we found that that doesn't work. You have to change the context within which the fire occurs.
Well, explain that further. My understanding is that the trick is to get to the fires as quickly as possible, right? And contain them.
That is the assumption, and it's really the same assumption we would have in cities. And, you know, I don't want free-burning fires in cities. And but part of what makes fire protection in cities work is that you have hydrants, you have building codes, you have zoning codes, you have fire codes. You have lots of other things that help to work with firefighting to contain the fires and to limit them. And so you have really large fires where you have some kind of social breakdown or infrastructure breakdown, say with earthquakes or in wars or some kind of massive civil unrest, so the apparatus doesn't work. But we don't have similar kinds of control over the countryside. Now, places like Greece and Portugal used to, when they had much more close cultivation of the countryside, in some ways overly close cultivation and damaging. But when they joined the EU and came out of dictatorships, they also had to deal not only with climate change, but the global economy. And so they've lost the countryside. People have left. They're not there. They're not practicing the same kinds of things that in the past would help contain fires. So you have a kind of feral countryside mixed with sort of out-migration of people, mixed with a breakdown in the capacity to fight fires, certainly to plan for fires. And then on top of that, you have climate change aggravating the fire scene. You put that all together, it's a pretty toxic mix.
But in terms of climate change, you mentioned that the Arctic weather patterns have changed, and we talked about how the jet stream has been stalled over the Northern Hemisphere, causing this enormous heat wave. Is that the new normal, or is that an anomaly?
I can't speak to that. I'm not a climatologist. I'm not a meteorologist. I just hear what other people who really research that topic say. That seems to be the case, but you know, I can't give you a definitive answer on that.
Well, but we've had, in 2003, there was a European heat wave. In 2010, there was a heat wave in Russia with lots of fires. In 2011, Texas and Oklahoma had a big drought. And in 2016, Canada had a lot of wildfires. So it does seem that they're happening with more frequency, particularly intense this year.
That seems to be the case. We seem to be picking up both the frequency and the intensity of these outbursts. But the outbursts themselves, the basic conditions, go back a long time. There were, in fact, a couple of years ago, a paper came out back more recently than that, looking at the last 700 years of large fires in Sweden. And Sweden has always had these kinds of things, but it may be picking up in intensity. So, you know, and I can't go on the record saying that this is because of a breakdown in the Arctic weather system. I don't know that. That seems to be what people are saying. It makes sense to me, but I can't speak authoritatively on that. I can tell you something about how, whatever the cause, the ultimate cause is, the expression of these fires is interacting with society to create problems that we don't really want. Fires, bad fires that we don't want, and often make more difficult the ability to put in good fires, which we do, and in many ways to have good fires substitute for bad fires.
Well, let's talk a little about that. A good fire, I take it, is something that forests need, right? The brush needs to be thinned out periodically.
Well, good fires promote the ecological integrity, if you will, of the landscape. They're the kinds of fires plants and animals have grown up with, even over evolutionary time, that they're adapted to. It's the patterning of fire in the landscape. There are fires that advance human interests. And in some part of that may be reducing fuel loads so that you don't get explosive fires. But that can also just be one of many benefits of sort of ecological burning or traditional good burning. Bad fires are fires that kill people, burn houses, destroy municipal watersheds. They may be fires that are outside sort of the evolutionary experience of this biota, so that they're adapted to one kind of fire, but if you get a different kind of fire, they can't accommodate that, and they can do damage. So sure, it's a human judgment, but that's what we do, and that has to guide our decisions about what kinds of fires we're willing to have and what kinds of fires we want to prevent and what kinds we want to promote.
But how do you stop a good fire from becoming a bad fire?
Well, that's a great question, because some are going to go bad. They are going to go feral. And part of it is that ultimately the way you control the regime of fire is by controlling the larger landscape. And if you have enough good fire out there, it begins to act as a kind of buffering. It quells it. So if a fire does escape the places you want it, burns differently than you expected, you are able to sort of contain it. Whereas now in too many landscapes, if a fire goes bad, it's just going to run. And there's not much we can do when it's blowing and going to stop it. So it's a long practice. One of the curiosities is the interest in returning to more traditional ecological knowledge, kinds of burning that American Indians did, Australian Aborigines, other people who managed to live in fire-prone landscapes for hundreds or thousands of years without being burned out. And we lost that, and there are efforts now to try to reimagine, adapt that to sort of modern circumstances, and in that way get the kind of fire that really serves our interest and that of the ecosystem better.
So, obviously, people are intruding more and more into natural landscapes because people want to live close to nature. And is there any way that there can be improvements made to the kind of building materials, people who choose to live close to forests or in forests?
Sure. That's a good question. And there has actually been a lot of research on why do houses actually burn. And we see images of towering flames. You just see this tsunami of fire bearing down on someplace. But that breaks down as you get closer to communities. And what really burns down structures are embers. You have blizzards of sparks. And as one researcher put it, the embers will find a way. If you have thousands and thousands of embers converging on a structure, if there is any point of vulnerability there, they will find it. And since we can't put people in the midst of that, we don't have any way to stop it. So designing houses better to accept that kind of ember storm, or ember attack, as the Aussies like to describe it, is certainly one way. Getting rid of combustible roofs, that's been known forever. But hardening some of our houses, not putting combustible vegetation right next to combustible walls and entryways and stairways and houses is another one. Just a lot of simple things, actually. It doesn't require a radical reform, but it's possible to harden these houses and to begin thinking about these communities, either some that are further out, the further suburbs or exurbs, as little urban enclaves, and to manage them as parts of a city, a tiny part of a city, but still a town, and bring that kind of urban fire protection and control with zones and building materials and so forth, bring that to bear, rather than assuming these are just wildland or rural fires and a few houses get in the way. I think we need to pick up the other end of that stick. If you do, then it's pretty clear what you have to do to prevent these structures from burning. And it's something we've known. I mean, it's like watching measles or polio come back because we decided we didn't need to vaccinate anymore. And then once you get a series of these houses or something on the fringe area under fire, then it can spread simply as an urban fire. And that's something in this country we haven't seen for a long time and thought we really didn't, it wasn't a problem anymore. But well, it is.
We just saw that in Reading, right?
We saw it in Reading. You saw it in Northern California, even in Santa Rosa last year. We're seeing it all over. And it's not just in the West. I mean, Gatlinburg, Tennessee, for heaven's sakes, burning. So a lot of the story right now has been one of Westerners building houses where there are fires. But in many ways, particularly if climate change models turn out to be correct, we may see the fires going to where the structures are. And that's going to be in the east, particularly the southeast, which is ill-prepared for that kind of fire condition.
Well, Stephen Pine, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate the information you've given us about fires, which are, as we mentioned, are not just here in California, but in Greece and Sweden and all around the world, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pine, who's an author and expert on the history, ecology, and management of fire. He's the Regents Professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University and the author of Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Baby,